Thank you for tuning into KCAW Sitka this evening for a special live presentation of Sitka Tells Tales, presented by Art Change Inc. and KCAW Raven Radio. We are excited to bring you five stories tonight from five different storytellers in the theme of It's Not Me, It's You. Stories of bad jobs, horrible roommates, and broken hearts. I am going to pass the mic over to Ellen, who will be introducing our storytellers. Ellen, take it away.
Thank you, Brian, and thank you, Raven Radio, for helping us share this adaptation of Sitka Tells Tales, True Stories Told Live. It's kind of an exciting, perhaps positive day on the national news front, and it's also our second live radio event. Now, normally and over the past years, we'd be gathered in person, packing people into a small space to listen to each other, to connect over stories, to laugh together and maybe tear up. You'd hear a clinking of cups and glasses, the shuffling of chairs, the murmur of a crowd. Well, we've all missed those types of things, right? At some point, Sitka Tells Tales will be in person again. But what we learned when we did the last live storytelling event on air as a radio event, that while we missed being together physically in a space, airing live shows does make Sitka Tells Tales an accessible experience, something you can tune into wherever you are. So we're going to do it again. So get cozy, put your feet up, and sip a warm beverage. As Brian mentioned, there will be five stories tonight to the theme of It's Not Me, It's You, stories of horrible roommates, bad jobs, and broken hearts. These are true tales filled with dirty dishes, confusing and uncertain moments, and these are stories about trust, frustration, and realization. So as you listen, your job, your role, is to root for the tellers who have stepped up to share a bit of their lives with you. So our tellers are, in this order, and I will try not to mess up anybody's name, Robin McNeely, Andrew Scorselli, Blossom Teal Olson, Nicole Fiorino, and Aaron Minx. Now, I just want to say we picked this date because it's a non-assembly night, Tuesday, and though it's 4:20, we don't have any stories about weed. So now, for the first of our five tellers, Robin. Now, Robin currently lives in Sitka with one daughter, one boyfriend, one dog, six chicks, eight hens, five pullets, and three roosters. She still does the majority of the dishes. Take it away, Robin.
Okay, hi. I'm Robin McNeely, and I'm just going to start by explaining that I come from an ocean, a vast array of single-family suburban households. Nobody I knew ever had roommates growing up. It was unheard of to have a roommate, except, you know, it wasn't unheard of because my mom, I was conceived in a commune, a fact which my mom and dad both confirm quite clearly and both have the details matching quite clearly, which is way too much information for a daughter, if you ask me, but they didn't ask me, they told me. So after that incredibly normal childhood, I grew up, moved out, became a young adult, and discovered that the only way not to spend every dime I earned on housing is to live with other people. I'm a pretty easygoing person and easy to get along with, and I found almost everybody I've ever lived with to be an enriching and interesting experience. I started my first roommate experience started here in Sitka with the underneath part of Gary and Mary Gauker's house, but I'm not talking about here in Sitka. I'm going to tell you about sharing a home a three-story hovel owned by a goat farming slumlord in Chico, California. In this three-story hovel, I lived with Steve and Terry and Barbie and Andy and Rod and sometimes Sid, although not all at the same time. It was kind of a revolving door of hippie house, and it was a three-story multi-bedroom house, and we could just fit a lot of people in. But Steve and Terry considered themselves artists, bad artists. They were clinically bad at art, but not like I'm insulting them. They reveled in their bad art. They loved making terrible, awful, cacophonic art from the basement, generally at 3 a.m, and it would seep up through the floorboards and just permeate the whole house. But it wasn't just bad musical art that they made. They made also terrible mixed media paintings and performance art. But it was the paintings that let me know that one day when I wandered around the house looking for a drinking cup for me and or my four-year-old daughter, finding no dishes, usable dishes anywhere, that I knew that I was going to have to descend into the pits of the bad art basement. And when I got there, it was even worse than I feared it would be, because I was faced with walls covered in bad art, surrounded by hobbled together workbenches, covered with every dish in the entire house, which were filled with the most noxious, toxic, fumy, paint-like tar substances you have ever seen. I don't even know. Dishes ruined. There was nothing salvageable to be seen anywhere. My Care Bear cup, my favorite fluted drinking glass, all of them unusable. I would never, even if you wash them out, I wouldn't trust eating or drinking from these objects ever again. I went straight to the thrift store, bought a whole bunch more dishes, made sure they looked very different from the old dishes so I wouldn't accidentally incorporate those old dishes into the eating routine, and put those in the cupboards. Then other roommates came in and they brought dishes and they put those in the cupboards. And then slowly the dishes from the basement filtered their way up just like I knew they would. And they made it into the cupboards. Soon there were so many dishes that everybody decided that nobody had to do the dishes ever again. Why would you wash a dish if you could just get another dish out of the cupboard and put it in the sink or on the counter or further down on the counter? And soon, oh my gosh, to do any cooking whatsoever, you would have to wash a mountain of dishes, eat, wash another mountain of dishes, and then after you'd done all those dishes, there would still be dishes. And I did the majority of these razzle-frackin' dishes. Until one day, I had had it. You know, when you hit that landmark moment where you're like, this is it. And curse words, loudness, I must have gotten my point across. I'm like, I'm taking me and my little girl and we're going to the park. And if I come back here and this kitchen isn't spotless, terrible things are gonna happen and I'm going to make them happen. I'm pretty easygoing and roll pretty smoothly most of the time, but I must have made an impression. Because when I came back from several hours at the park with my little girl, the kitchen was spotless. And it even stayed spotless for almost 2.5 whole days. Crisis averted. Everything was fine. So we lived with the, it's still roommates. The dishes still build up. But I knew that I could put my foot down every now and then, and it made a difference. Life went on. And I can't even tell you why I found myself standing on the sink, opening the cabinets above the sink that were too high for anybody to reach. I was probably looking for a place to store a blender. But it was weeks since I had pitched a fit, and I opened this cabinet, and I find out why the kitchen had been so spotless, because every dirty dish was now in a disgusting, moldering pile, not even stacked. I think some of them fell out on me as I opened the cabinet. Clattering, moldy dishes that had been hidden, not washed, hidden in the cabinets. It was that day, stumbling down from the top of the sink, that I decided I was moving out. I didn't get to move out that day, but that was the day I decided that I had had it with this roommate situation, this house situation, this everything situation. I took me and my daughter and my newborn baby and my husband, and we moved out to a new house with my husband's best childhood friend, Richard. So, in everything that I've told you about Steve and Terry, and please understand, they're still on my Facebook, and I love them dearly, and I feel enriched by them. But Richard was the saintly opposite of everything that they stood for. Richard did dishes. He loved to do the dishes. I don't even know what excuse he gave, like the feeling of the warm soapy water, or it was just a chore he knew how to do, or his mom just raised him right. But not only did Richard do the dishes, Richard, when he washed dishes, washed every dish. He washed the plates, he scrubbed the pans, and the man even sought out, found, and washed the baby's bottles. I point this out because if I were a young bachelor or bachelorette living in a house full of children that were not mine, I am telling you that I would never, not once, wash bottle one. I didn't make those kids. I ain't washing their dishes. But Richard, saint that he is a better person than me. And he washed my dishes, my daughter's dishes, my husband's dishes, his own dishes, the stranger's dishes. He washed every dish. Until eventually, Richard got a girlfriend. And then she came over and he washed her dishes. And then eventually he moved out and he's still washing her dishes. And I'll tell you this, I've never felt, you know, a romantic way towards Richard. We have been good platonic friends for all as long as I've known him. But I have never felt as jealous of a woman than I feel of his girlfriend to this day, right now. Because I'm still washing the dishes.
Okay. Thank you so much, Robin, reminding us that it's the small things that can both drive us crazy and make us adore someone. So you are tuned into a special live presentation of Sitka Tells Tales. Now, please welcome our next storyteller, Andrew Scorselli, and he will introduce himself.
My time, but in our sons and daughters' time, when you get the feeling, call and you got a room.
Well, it was 1996, the winter of, or it was 1997. Me and my BFF and some of our other wild, crazy fish gypsy friends here from Sitka, Alaska, decided to move on down to Portland, Oregon. Somebody had a dream about it, so we decided to move there, and it turned out it was Portlandia before Portland, before Portlandia, that is. Some of us, a lot of us had these notions we wanted to do some art instead of, like, kill fish and travel around the world and backpack and stuff like that, take a winter and focus on our art. Some of us wanted to sew. Some of us wanted to paint pictures. Some of us wanted to write and tell stories, by God. And we tried to do that. A couple things went awry. Some of us, money didn't come through. We had to get jobs and whatnot. And anyway, there was about six of us from up here, people we'd camped with and fished with and whatnot. We all got this house in North Portland, and that was great. Six humans, two dogs, two cats, an iguana, various mushrooms growing in various closets all over the house. And at some point, though, we lost one of the roommates. And the lesbian couple in the house convinced us to bring in a new roommate, a young lesbian, a little spiky, spunky, funky girl, about 19, who was awesome. Her name was Sarah. And we interviewed her and had her move in. She had little spiky blue hair and her her Indigo Girls shirt. We're all pumped about her. And everybody was doing their thing. We were parking cars for a living. Some of us were waiting tables, whatnot. Well, one day, young Sarah called a house meeting. We all gathered around in the kitchen. And she said, I got a meeting. Everybody's got to come together. I got an announcement to make. And we were all like, okay, what is it? You know, the two cats are rubbing our ankles and the dogs are like sitting there. The iguana's purring. We all want to know. She's keeping us in suspense, you know, and she's doing it on purpose. And we're all like, well, what's up, Sarah? What's going on? She's like, well, I just have something to say. You know, I've been thinking about it and I've been going through this whole thing and like, I'm officially changing my name. But for now on, my name, I'm no longer Sarah. That's it. Not calling myself Sarah. And we're like, well. Like, what's your new name? What do we say? Who are you now? What is it? We can't wait to hear it. What's up? What do we call you now? She's like, well, it's just, look, for now on, I just, if somebody calls or, I'm no longer Sarah. It's old. It's oppressive. It has connotations that I don't groove with. It's oppressing. We're like, all right, well, what is it? And finally, I'm like, all right, well, you know, if somebody calls, you know, on the telephone, you know, this is pre-cell phones, by the way, everybody. If somebody calls on the house telephone, like, who do we say is here? She's like, well, she looks around the room, her eyes darting wildly. She's like, well, I'm wild. I'm like, I mean, I want to laugh, but I didn't. And nobody else did. You know, the lesbian couple were like her, you know, bringing her under her wing and whatnot, which I always thought was cool. They were supportive. And so was I. I thought it was cool. And it was like, right on, wild, cool, you know, welcome to it. Well, I noticed as time went on, I was the only one who called it wild. You know, everybody else seemed to forget. But she'd be coming around, you know, she'd be coming down the stairs, she'd be coming down the stairs, holding on the banister, holding the railing, coming in the front door, coming in the kitchen, you know, coming in from the kitchen. I'd be sitting on the couch and I would see her and I'd be like, I'm gonna say it. I want to respect her new thing, you know. I'm going to say, you know, sup, wild, sup, you know. I'm not going to call her Sarah anymore. But it was like, every time it was like I'd be looking at myself as if I was in a movie. And it would just happen. I didn't mean to do it. But every time I thought I'd be like, sup, wild. But instead I'd be like, yo, what's up, wild, what's up, wild, whoa, whoa. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, like. So wow, what's up? You know, and after a while, she just stopped calling herself wild, and nobody else did. The lesbian couple never called it that, and everybody just forgot about it. And you know, I let it go, and in the end, you know, she left the house. She left us all a really crummy, crappy note, calling us all names and whatever. And turned out she'd been lying about going to work every day. She didn't really have a job. She's actually like smoking crack or whatever, you know, like left us all hanging with the bills, you know, didn't pay the rent, scapped out a couple days beforehand. And it really sucked. But you know what? I don't care. Because in the end, even though nobody else did, to me, for me, she'll always be wild. She's wild. I mean, wow. Wow, girl, what's up, wow? That's to you, girl. This is me saying, yo, what's up, wow? Love you, babe. Woo! Ow! Thanks, everybody. That's my little tale. Peace. Through a township window.
That was wild. Thank you, Andrew. Who I've also known as Andy. And now we're ready for our third storyteller, Blossom Teal Olson. Blossom is a local Inupiaq writer who lives in Sitka with her husband and three children. Please welcome Blossom.
Blossom. Hi, I'm Blossom. And tonight I am going to tell you about growing up in Fairbanks, Alaska. Most of all of my stories are about growing up in Fairbanks. Number one, because I thoroughly enjoyed growing up there. It was during the 80s when the pipeline was booming. It seemed like everyone was getting married then. Everyone was happy. All the kids knew the price of gold. That was part of growing up. My family would always move away here and there, but we'd always go back to Fairbanks one way or another. Growing up, we always lived downtown in downtown Fairbanks. We were never one of the quote-unquote fortunate kids that lived out in the university district or out in the boonies. We were downtown kids, and that was our life. We lived downtown. We lived right in the heart of Fairbanks, right in the heart of the old houses and the old miner cabins. And my sister and I were always working. My mother was older, and she adopted us, and she was a single parent, so we were always working. We had multiple newspaper routes, and when I was younger, since I was a good kid, I would take notes down to Lindy's. Lindy's was a grocery store on Barnett Street, and I was given notes to take to Lindy's, and I'd pick up cigarettes for people and deliver them to the older people who lived downtown. And because I was a good kid, and they knew I wouldn't smoke their cigarettes, I think I delivered alcohol there as well. And they did that up until he closed in, I think, 88. But that was our life downtown. And by the time the 90s rolled around, it seemed like everyone was getting divorced because the pipeline wasn't getting as much attention. And that's what it seemed. Everyone was getting divorced. And by that time, I was 11, and we lived at the townhouse apartments. And it wasn't the best places to live. None of the places we lived downtown were the best places. In fact, I think I lived in all the worst places you could live. I lived in China Court, in Fairview Manor, townhouse apartments, and townhouse motel. By that time, it was across the street there on 11th and Cushman from the old Maranatha Inn. That old building was empty by then, and all that was left was this old sign that said Maranatha on it. And what I like to say is everything in Fairbanks seemed like it was nice at one time. And from what I heard, the Maranatha Inn was nice at one time. It was much like the YMCA, I believe. There wasn't much to do at the townhouse apartments. I was 11. By that time, my sister had moved out. She had left my mother, who had had a number of heart attacks, and she left us with a newborn baby. So I was hustling when I was younger, but I had entered a whole new level of making money because I needed to help my mother, who was in her mid-60s, take care of this little boy who was a newborn. And I didn't really quite know where this was going. So one night we heard this commotion, and our next door neighbor was out in the hallway, and they were like, you heard this man? He said, we got to find someone. And we opened the door, he knocked, and he said, do you babysit? He's like, yeah, I babysit. He said, I'll give you a couple $100 if you could watch our kid. Now, from what we heard, the guy owned a topless place, and his girlfriend was his new girlfriend. My mother was an ex-cop and corrections officer, and she knew everything about everyone. So she knew that he had left his wife and He was living with his girlfriend who they had their little son, and he said, "I'll give you a couple $100 if you could watch our kid for a couple hours. We gotta go." It was surprising to me because all of a sudden, because of this commotion, this lady was out there in nothing. Almost, she was working that night, so she had this sparkly silver outfit, and I was always raised in this conservative household, so seeing this woman completely almost naked, you know, surprised me. But the couple $100 for the hour or two intrigued me, so we went and I babysat for them, and there entered George and his girlfriend, and they kind of entered. They entered our life then. I babysat for them. A lot of my mother's friends didn't like that I babysat for him because he owned a topless bar and that she was a dancer. But surprisingly, they're very wholesome. They're very kind. They bought us baby formula and baby supplies for my nephew. And they paid me very, very well. And number one, they treated me like a kid. Because at that time, I was thrusted into this world of taking care of, you know, my family. And I was all ready to be an adult. And because of their interactions, yes, it was surprising to have these people in our lives. And surprisingly, my mother allowed them to be a part of our lives. But they were so instrumental in letting me be a kid and paying me well and fair, and they treated their little son just amazingly. And I was raised, you know, in a very conservative home, and you know, the thought of having, you know, a free mind and a free body, and to have a woman figure be confident with her body was very, very big for me. So they were neighbors that I'll never forget, and they really did change my life. And that was part of living down in Fairbanks. I babysat for George and his stripper girlfriend, and they're awesome. So never judge people for what they do. They're awesome. Thanks.
Thank you so much for your story, Blossom. A good, thoughtful story that makes us think about our neighbors and not judging people. And a job that could have been horrible, but really wasn't. So we have heard three stories, and we have just two more coming up on this special radio edition of Sitka Tells Tales here on KCAW. Our next story comes from Nicole Fiorino. Originally from Boston, Nicole is the curator at the Sitka Historical Society and Museum. She has blue eyes, pink hair, and once played a flying monkey in a production of The Wizard of Oz. Here's Nicole.
Hi, I'm Nicole. And I'm the curator of Sitka Historical Society. This is going to be a story about a bad job. This is a very bad job. I was 16, and I loved summer camp. And so when I was 16, I had the opportunity to work at this camp. It was called Chimney Corners Camp for Girls in the Berkshires, in Western Massachusetts. And I was all about it. I was like, yes, I've gone to this camp for years as a camper. I'm totally in. Great. So I get to camp, you know, they do kind of like this introduction and this, you know, first week where they, you know, basically are supposed to teach you how to deal with kids. Well, that week I learned first aid. I learned how to teach archery. I learned how to teach pottery, how to, you know, care for horses, But we never actually learned how to interact with kids, which looking back on it probably was a problem. So as I was 16, I decided, you know, when I was there, I had two co-counselors. Both of my co-counselors were 18, 19, and they had done it before. They had been counselors before. I was brand new, never been there. And so, you know, I kind of figured that they were going to be the ones that, you know, kind of gave us, you know, gave me some direction and helped us plan, you know, to help me plan activities and things like that. They didn't do that. They kind of just decided that they were friends and, you know, the other people around them were friends and they were going to do their own thing. You know, as a sleepaway camp, we were working 124 hours a week, I think. 124 hours. We had some time off. We had two nights off during the week and one day off. So we would have two nights that was from 5 to 11. And then the full day off was from 5 p.m. to 5 p.m. the next day. The way that, you know, the camp set it up was that you weren't allowed to take time off at the same time as one of your co-counselors. Well, my co-counselors ignored them. They decided, you know what? Nicole will be fine. We can leave her. She's 16. She can be in charge of 10 year olds. It'll be fine. It was not fine. It was most definitely not fine. You know, it was just, you know, like, how do you, you're 6 years older than these kids. You know, that's the age difference between my sister and I. I can't get my sister to listen to me. There's no way. So I tried to talk to the head counselor, tried to, you know, explain to her. I was like, I really don't know, you know, what I'm doing. I need some help here. Well, that apparently was the wrong thing to do. Shouldn't have asked for help either. Because from then on, my co-counselors hated me because I had, you know, turned them in and, you know, their behavior didn't stop. It was fine. And I distinctly remember that we had this thing called the day hike where we went on a field trip with the kids and we went on a hike. I am not a hiker. I may live in Sitka now, but I am not a hiker. And I remember that against the rules, both my co-counselors had taken that day off. And I woke up the morning of that hike and I was sick. I was very sick. And I remember going to breakfast that morning and meeting up with the counselor who was in charge of taking these field trips. And I remember just sitting at the table and just bursting into tears, being like, I'm sick. I can't do this. I'm sorry. And she was like, oh, don't worry about it. Like, go to the infirmary. You'll be fine. I'll take care of them. And I remember the next day when I had been released from the infirmary, I was the one that got in trouble. It was no problem that both of my coworkers had taken the day off when they weren't supposed to. But it was my fault for being sick and still not going with the kids. I should also mention here, we worked for 9 weeks. I made $600 for the entire summer. $600. We did the math out and it was like 40 cents an hour. I mean, yes, you're sleeping for a part of that, but like, I don't know why I actually took the job looking back on it. Like, I think it was, you know, that we loved this place. We loved this camp so much. And, you know, we kind of just felt like it was worth it. And, you know, it was really hard for me to realize this place I loved so much kind of had this, you know, really bad, I ended up with a really bad taste in my mouth. And I remember it got to the point where my counselors had complained to the head of our unit. You know, there are three units of ages of kids. And I guess she had talked to the director. So I'm on my one day off and I get a phone call from the director saying that she's heard all of these complaints and that I've been doing a terrible job. And so, you know, I'm devastated. I'm so upset. And the rest of my day off is ruined. So I go back the next day, and she calls me into a meeting with her. I'm getting fired. Like, I didn't get fired, but she was basically asking me to quit. She said, you know, if you want, if you, it's okay if you want to leave now, like, we won't hold it against you. And I had that moment where I was like, you know what? I could quit now and I could go home, but I need to prove to myself that I can do this. I need to prove to myself that, you know, there are going to be some people that you don't like working with and you don't enjoy spending time with, but that's not the point. The point is that you are strong enough to be able to figure out how to work through it. It was definitely a hard lesson as a 16-year-old, you know, without family, but it really helped me understand, you know, that not everybody is in it for the right reasons, and that's okay. And it gave me, you know, a real understanding and helped me become a better person. So, you know, really bad job ended up being a positive learning experience, I guess. Not a good experience, but a positive learning one.
Okay, if we were in the room, I'm sure I could see and feel you all cringing, because that was a rough one. $600, a lot of pain, and maybe some insight. Thank you, Nicole. So again, you are tuned into a special presentation of Sitka Tells Tales here on Raven Radio. We have just one more story this evening coming from Aaron Minks. And Aaron is an Okie by birth and a happy wanderer by life, preferably doing so slowly from a seat of a bicycle. Okay, take it away, Aaron.
¿Dónde estabas tú?
Hey, thanks for having me. So yeah, I'm an Okie by birth. This story takes place in South America, in Peru, to be exact. And I'd been living down there for a little while. I was about 23. Got my first passport when I was 21. And ended up in South America. This was my first trip. And ran out of money. I ended up getting a job in central Chile for a while. And was able to save a little bit of money. And I bought a bicycle. And I was doing a bike trip that started out with not much of a plan. But I did a loop around the southern part of Argentina, and I was working my way back north, and the story takes place in southern Peru. So my daily routine was, as soon as I was about nightfall, I would look for a place to camp. And I always felt more comfortable camping just off the road in a spot just out of sight of cars and whatnot. So I was right before a town called Ollantaytambo, and I was pulling up right when a truck came by with a big crane on the back that had hit the electrical poles in this town and was sending sparks everywhere. And I had stopped along with the entire village, it seemed like, that came out to check and see what was going on. And I was standing over my bike, kind of contemplating if I was going to keep going or go back and camp or what I was going to do. And I was kind of a little bit of mayhem, and a person appeared to my right and said, walked up to me and said, "Tú y yo somos lo mismo." You and I were the same. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know the person. I looked him up and down. He was had on a leather jacket and some nice jeans. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And we both kind of observed the scene in front of us. And then he said, "Hey, why don't you come over here and have a seat and we'll have a chat." So, okay. And came over, sat down, and he said his name was Dario. He started to chat and he told me a story a little bit. And he said he was had been a successful businessman in Lima, the capital of Peru. And then he had moved to this little town up in the Andes because he felt called by Los Apus. Now, I'd done a little bit of traveling through the Andes, so I already knew about Los Apus a little bit, which are the spirits of the mountains. Inca, this is like pre-Columbian history, Los Apus, Inca culture. And he talked to me about a little bit about how he had been a successful businessman, and then he had felt called and he had left Lima and come to southern Peru. And I thought, well, this guy's interesting. He has an interesting story. And I was still contemplating if I was going to go south or north for the night and camp. And he said, "Well, you should come stay up at my place instead of camping." And I thought, oh, okay. Guy's a little bit odd, but I was a little bit odd too. So I said, "All right, let's do it." So we took off and we went down a couple steps down the street, and he said, let's stop here and grab some dinner. So we pulled into this little place, and he said, "We'll take some more chicha," which is this type of corn alcohol that they drink in Peru, "and some bread." And so we took that and we went on up the hill to his place, and we walked up and up and up, and it just seemed continuous uphill. We finally got to this little adobe hut overlooking the valley, and it was absolutely beautiful. And I started to set my tent up outside, and he said, no, you can come stay inside the house. So I went inside, and as I was starting to kind of lay on my mat, he brought out a drum and he started playing this drum and singing. So he's singing about the Apus, and he would sing a chorus that was along the lines of "Y los Apus cantarán, cantarán, cantarán." And at one point he looked at me as if it was my turn to sing my own part of the song, which I did. And later, a little bit, he continued drumming and we continued singing into the night. And I was hoping a little bit I'd pitch my tent outside, but I hadn't. So we continued, and he stopped all of a sudden and looked out the door and said, "Tú no vas a llevar a mi amigo," to something outside the door. And I couldn't see anything. I looked and I saw nothing. And he said to me, "It's an Apu and he's here to take you." And I thought, wow, okay. I was feeling a little bit apprehensive to my choice of sleeping for the night, but he would keep singing and periodically look to the door, looking at the supposed Apu, and then look back at me. And this went on throughout the entire night, where he would drum and sing and look towards the door and look towards me. And I eventually curled up in the corner, telling Dadio that I needed to get some rest, and looking towards him, which he continued to look out the door towards the Apu. And I slept. I didn't really sleep at all. I had my eyes closed just a little bit, where you can see through your eyelashes, as Dadio drummed into the night repeatedly. I didn't sleep a wink. And as soon as the light broke through the door, I popped up and said, "Oh, I'm good. I think I'm going to leave. I appreciate the night, Dadio." And he said, "All right, before you leave, we must go around the corner, because you have to meet Doña Maria." And I thought, "Oh, okay, Doña Maria." And Dadio took me around the corner to the back of the house, where there was a piece of canvas covering an empty block of adobe, which he pulled back, and there was a human skull along with a picture of a woman who was Doña Maria. And Dadio said, "This is Doña Maria. Ella nos cuida. She cares for us." I said, "Thank you, Dadio." And I coasted down the hill back into Ollantaytambo for the next day to take a nap as soon as I could in the local square.
Well, that was a strange and wonderful tale. And I want to say, give a huge thanks to Aaron and all our other storytellers for bringing Sitka Tells Tales to life on the radio. I want to thank Micah Pruitt, who is behind the scenes timing our tellers. To the Sitka Daily Sentinel and the Sitka Soup for getting the word out. And to all of you tuned in here on KCAW Raven Radio. Now, if you're in town and you see one of these tellers on the street or in the grocery store, be sure to let them know you heard their story. And even mention a line you heard that resonated, made you laugh, or made you think of your own story. So what's up next? We're aiming to do another Sitka Tells Tales radio event, most likely in June. The theme for now is Sleepless in Sitka, stories of being awake in the night. It's inspired by a discussion earlier today about insomnia. As with all our themes, they're open to interpretation. If you're sleepless in Sitka, it could be a story of a night job, traveling in the dark, or caretaking, or whatever you think. So what do you think about that? We're fueled by feedback and community participation. If you have other theme ideas or interest in telling a 6-minute true tale, please let us know. We love to hear new voices. You don't have to be in Sitka to participate on the air in events. And you can contact us through our Facebook page for Sitka Tells Tales, or by texting and contacting me, Ellen Frankenstein, like the monster, at 907-738-2174. And thanks again. Be well and tune in again for more Sitka Tales Tales, presented both live and from the vault on Raven Radio.
Just wanna give up. Well, me too.
Thank you again for tuning into this special live presentation of Sitka Tells Tales here on KCAW Sitka.